Literacy is a bridge from misery to hope. It is a tool for daily life in modern society. It is a bulwark against poverty. So said former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. How does the struggle for literacy among children from disadvantaged communities play out over time? Joining me is a teacher turned scholar who has explored inequity, discrimination, and school failure through a decade-long study of literacy. For a program entitled Literacy for Life, I'm joined by Catherine Compton Lilly, professor of literacy education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author of books such as Reading Families, Rereading Families, Reading Time, and most recently, Reading Students' Lives, Literacy Learning Across Time. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Glad to be here.
It may seem like an obvious question, but I'd like to start with why does literacy matter? Yeah. First of all, how do you define literacy? And also, you know, how important is it?
Literacy is so important because literacy is one of the primary ways in which we learn about our world and also be able to share other people's stories, other people's lives, understand other people's worlds. Reading and writing, of course, helps us in school and helps us get good grades and to be able to engage with science or math or whatever content area you're in. But literacy is also both a way of, like I said, learning about other people, but also it's a way of expressing your own ideas and who you are. So literacy would entail reading and writing, but in modern world, academics who think about literacy also think about viewing and, viewing films, viewing artwork, any kind of communicative mode that conveys information is considered a literacy. So literacy is larger than reading and writing, although in my own work I tend to focus mostly on reading and writing and how that happens in schools.
I always find it incredibly painful to look back at something like Frederick Douglass's narrative where he refers to the fact that it was against the law to teach a slave to read and write, and his struggle secretly to obtain that because he saw it as the gateway out of bondage. This country has a pretty bad record when it comes to who gets literacy.
Definitely. And that continues today. Although we have public schooling for everybody, the kinds of experiences kids get in those schools, the kinds of books they have access to, the number of books they have access to, the number of books in communities and library access is very different for kids from different communities. So literacy is definitely something that will allow you to engage in different vocations, different educational experiences. It can lead to all kinds of options in your future. But it's not equally distributed to everybody in American society, and it's always been that way. I think now it's a little less obvious because we do see all our kids going to school, but again, the quality of those schools is drastically different.
Well, and certainly here in Wisconsin, we're aware with the Race to Equity report of the terrible achievement gap. It's one of the worst in the countries in terms of the gap between black and white children in school for dropout rate and for achievement. Right?
Yeah, definitely. And that is something that I think across the United States we struggle with, but I think it's particularly obvious in our data here in Wisconsin. The schools that I write about and the school that I taught in for many years was a school that probably looked a lot like some of the schools in Milwaukee, where you have neighborhoods where it's a hard place to raise children. There's not a lot of resources. There's sometimes not even a grocery store or a drugstore nearby. There's a lot of people who are trying to find ways to support their families and sometimes doing it in ways that aren't ideal. The neighborhood I was in particular had a lot of drug use and those sorts of things. So, they're very difficult places to raise families, and they're very difficult places to be teachers. And I think those sorts of things contribute to this gap that we're seeing in education. I don't think it's just about teachers not doing their jobs. I think it's a lot much larger social issue that has to do with resources, communities, opportunities, safety, violence, and all those sorts of things that we want for our children and everyone mm-hmm. wants for their children.
In your most recent book, Reading Students' Lives, you talk about following families, following children at different points in their lives, starting from when you were their teacher to now as a scholar and sort of your own personal journey. Why do you think it's important, the work that you've been doing, to follow certain families over a trajectory, looking at them maybe in first grade and then again in sixth grade and 11th grade? Why does that kind of change the findings?
I think it's an unacknowledged story. I think it's a way of thinking about children that we think about with our own children. You know, when you're a parent, you watch your child go from first grade all the way up through high school, and you know things about them, and you see things in their 16-year-old selves that remind you of their 6-year-old selves, and you sort of have this long-term relationship with the children and understanding of who they are in deep ways. But I think the way our educational system is structured, that there's very few teachers or educators that have an opportunity to have that longitudinal understanding of children in their lives. I think that the way our schools are structured, kids are in first grade, then they go to second grade and get a new teacher, and then they go to third grade. Eventually, they end up in middle school, and there they're moving between several teachers, but they often don't have the same teachers in seventh grade that they had in eighth grade, and the same thing for high school. So there's almost no longitudinal knowledge of children, of who they were. One of the really interesting things I think about the work I've done is I've been able to follow particular children. So when I'm sitting there talking to a 17-year-old African-American high schooler who's, you know, a foot and a half taller than I am and, you know, is wearing his baggy jeans and his, you know, sports sweatshirt and, you know, I see not only this young adult sitting in front of me, but I also see the 6-year-old. And I recognize that, you know, that this is a person who's, you know, is not just your quintessential bad, you know, adolescent living in an inner city community. This is a child who, you know, I've seen since he was 6. I've watched him grow up. And I think that gives us a very different perspective. And I think I think there's two things about that. One is the way it changes the way educators might think about children. And the other is that it changes the relationship we have with those children. And instead of seeing children as threatening or as angry or as incompetent or as disenfranchised, we can see children as, you know, we can build relationships that build across time. So if I know a child or I follow a child over time, then I'm not going to be making those judgments as quickly.
Personal question, what drew you to the field of literacy in particular and took you out of the classroom and into the sort of the research focus?
Well, I did the research when, as I said, I was their first grade teacher and I got my doctorate. This was actually, the first book was my doctoral dissertation, so I got my doctorate, but I never intended to leave the public schools. So I stayed in the public schools for 5-6 years after that and continued to work in the same schools, the same neighborhood, sometimes saw the same children on their way to or from school. But over time, and actually I never planned to come to the university, I ended up following the kids and revisiting the families and talking to the families. But after the kids were in eighth grade, I was actually recruited by the University of Wisconsin to come and join the faculty there. And like I said, I never thought I would leave public schools because I saw myself as a teacher at heart. But knowing that I could come here meant that I'd be able to actually write about these children and to think about them and to do other research and to, you know, teach graduate students and doctoral students who shared my interests. So I never intended to be here, but it's been a happy happenstance.
So take us into the first grade classroom. I mean, that's sort of the first real school after kindergarten. A lot of work on reading happens then. But we've also seen recent studies that show that it's really the first 3 years of life that set vocabulary and almost chart a course for a child's destiny. So if you get a child in first grade, what already has happened in the family that may shape what you're seeing in front of you?
And I think the research tends to answer that question in two ways. In one way, people talk about what happened, but they're thinking about actually what didn't happen. Or they're thinking about the deficits, and you hear a lot of blaming of parents. Parents don't talk to their kids in the right way, or they don't read them storybooks, or they don't do all these things that middle-class parents and, you know, literacy scholars would say are the right things to do with kids. But I think the other way to look at it is, what are the parents actually doing? And this was one of the things that came out of that initial research, is there was a lot more going on in around literacy in these high-poverty urban homes than I think most people imagined. The teachers in the school would often complain about the parents, you know, the kid's never seen a book, he doesn't get read to, parents don't care. But when I actually started working with parents, I found they cared very, very deeply about their children. To the degree that they were, you know, willing to sit and talk with me over a 10-year period about their children and literacy. Just like any parent, they want the best for their children. And they were doing things. They may not be reading traditional stories to their kids, although some were, some definitely were, but they were helping kids with homework, and they were, telling stories, lots of storytelling in homes. Sometimes it's a story about what happened when I went to the market. Sometimes it's a story about what happened to your little brother, your big brother, when he was in first grade.
Using words and constructing narratives. Somewhere in the book, you also talk about a family where they had spent a lot of time at the library and valuing libraries, which was another way to sort of promote literacy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was Marvin's family. And Marvin and his grandfather spent a lot of time in the library. As a matter of fact, Marvin's grandfather talks about when he was in school, and he was 50 years old at the time of this study, so this must have been back in the 1940s when he was going to elementary school. And he had had trouble learning to read, but his mother was a teacher. And his mother said, we're going to take you to the library every Saturday until you learn to read. And he himself argues that he learned to read not through school, because in school the teachers put the kids who weren't reading well on one side of the classroom and virtually ignored them. At least this is his account. He believes he learned to read in the library, so he took his grandchildren to the library. And that is particularly the place where they got access to computers and technology. And he taught his grandson, to learn to use a computer at the library, as well as borrow books.
So if you look back now at the first grade class that sort of started off your research, can you introduce us to some of the children and then kind of take them or start with one and sort of look at what you learned from that one case study?
Marvin was a young man who he always wanted to be a police officer, and he was very interested in, the other boys at school. He hung around with them, palled around with them all the time. He had been retained in first grade, so I was his first grade teacher the second time he went through first grade. But before he had been in my class, he had been living with his parents, and his mother had a drug addiction problem. So he had actually moved in with the grandparents and stayed with those grandparents until he was 16 years old. So, this was a child who had had a difficult beginning. He also had an older sister who was there for him every day, picked him up after school, walked him home, lived with the same grandparents. The grandparents, like I said, were, a wonderful, very secure force in Marvin's life. So,
By repeating first grade, had he already then sort of experienced the stigma that can come from being labeled slow or, because there's a lot of controversy on when do you hold back a child as opposed to just pushing them ahead even if they don't have the skills.
And in his case, because of the situation with his mother and moving back and forth between the mother and the grandfather during that kindergarten year, he had actually missed a lot of school. So some of it wasn't just about ability, but it was devastating to be a year older. And as Marvin grew taller and taller, he towered over the other kids by the time he got into fourth and fifth grade. So, that was very difficult for him.
And how was his approach to literacy in terms of reading and writing and so on?
At first he was reticent to be involved, although he actually read better than most of the kids because he did have a year of first grade behind him. So he was actually a fairly strong reader. But he ended up, by the end of the year, he was reading second grade books, which was very good. And he did pretty well that first year. But, it was always a bit of a struggle because he missed his mother deeply, even though she had difficulties of her own.
And how much pressure was placed on you as a teacher by the various testing requirements and programs and the feeling that you're going to be held accountable, that schools may close if the scores are low and that kind of thing, and sort of teaching to a test?
And we were on the state's list of schools to be closed if our test scores didn't go up at the end of the year. So there was a lot of pressure on test scores and kids' achievement, and people were coming in and testing the kids every few weeks and sometimes doing assessments that were totally unrelated to what we were doing in the classroom, which was very frustrating. It was really a very stressful time. The state ed department was watching us. The school district was watching us. We had had something like 13 principals and vice principals cycle through the school in the last 2 years.
So that's a lot of turnover.
It was a lot of crazy turnover, and it wasn't good for the school because people are coming with really good intentions and wanting to do something, but they'd be shifted around before they got a chance to do much. So it was a very difficult time. We were one of the first schools in the state to be placed on the state review list. So they were still trying to figure out the process at the same time they were kind of imposing it on us.
What were some of the things that you actually did in the classroom as a first grade teacher to encourage a love of reading and also skills in literacy that would both sort of satisfy the test requirements but also have a lifelong impact?
Yeah. My major thing was, you know, if you can get kids reading, if you can get them into books they enjoy and to, you know, help them find a series perhaps or a set of books or an author that they really love, the best way to become a good reader is to continue to read. So once we get kids through that initial push, so we did a lot of taking their ideas, writing them on chart paper, reading them together. We used jump rope rhymes that they knew from their home and community as early text to help them learn to read and write. We tried to find books that they were interested in. We used big books so we could all read the same book together and look at the pictures and read the text in unison. We did lots of activities around helping them move from very simple books to more and more difficult gradually over time in small groups, so they'd be working with other kids that were at basically the same level they were. So we did a lot of different things, lots of reading and writing, but trying to make it holistic, trying to make it about real stories and real ideas and capturing their ideas on paper.
How important was it, as Gloria Ladson-Billings sometimes suggests in her work, that some of the characters in the book, some of the topics, be culturally relevant? In other words, that you have African-American and Latino characters in the books that children are reading.
Yeah, that's definitely critical. Definitely critical. And that the stories resonate with issues and ideas in their own lives. So, you know, one of the examples I think of sometimes is there were some books we had about children whose fathers had gone away and then come back. And some of the children were very attracted to that because that was very similar to their story. So thinking about some of the storylines, some of the motifs, some of the ideas that would engage them. And I think the other part is, the other piece of Gloria's work that's really important is that it's not just about the books you bring in. You also have to have relationships with people in the communities. And I think that's one thing that this research project did for me is it allowed me to spend, you know, hours talking to families and parents in particular about their lives and who they were and what they read and why they read and what books they loved as children and what teachers were inspiring to them and what made those teachers good teachers. And it generally was not, you know, they prepared me for the test. It was the relationship. It was this teacher cared about me as she took time with me. You know, I stayed after school and helped her. So all of these sorts of things I think are really important. And sometimes they're not as high on the educational agenda as I think they need to be.
So back to Marvin. If you trace Marvin over time, he's living with his grandparents, has sadness about his mother, was encouraged to use the library. What else was important about Marvin, and what did you trace over time?
Yeah, like I said, he always wanted to be a police officer, and He talked about that quite a bit, you know, over the different interviews. Unfortunately, by the time he got into high school, he actually was still thinking about his parents a lot and actually found his mother and moved back in with her. Unfortunately, she was still not in a good place, and he got in with the wrong group of kids and actually ended up being incarcerated for a couple of years. I actually went to visit him a couple times while he was incarcerated, and the joke was the second time I came back, the admissions person that checks you in when you go to visit someone, I heard him call into the back saying, "Hey, Marvin, your first grade teacher's here again." they all thought that was very funny that his first grade teacher would show up, but it was actually a very difficult situation for me. I didn't write much about what he talked about when he was incarcerated because once people are incarcerated, you cannot conduct research with them. So I visited him only as a friend. But when he was released, he actually went back to live with his grandfather and was trying very hard to get back on track. As a matter of fact, he was spending time with other friends who were, you know, older students who had gone back to high school, and they spent a lot of time in the library together. So the library came up as a motif again. But it's very difficult to be incarcerated and then to be, you know, released and then to be, you know, 20 years old and trying to figure out where you're going to go with your life.
And it's also sad to think that nothing could have been done to sort of make that not happen when the statistics are pushing that as a likely outcome here in Wisconsin, that there will be a failure in high school, there will be incarceration. You know, the likelihood of that is astonishingly high.
And that's where I think, you know, if we could find ways to reorganize schools so that children have relationships with teachers and that families have relationships with teachers over long periods of time, I think that'd be one way to counteract those kinds of, you know, incidences that happen. Because I really think, I think you're right. I think that was the hardest thing about conducting this research is watching some children not thrive. And they're children who you knew were, you know, charming and sweet and thoughtful and smart and capable. Marvin was very, very smart. He, like I said, once he came into my classroom after repeating first grade, he was reading at a second grade level by the end of the year. There was nothing wrong with him intellectually or morally. He had a commitment to, you know, like I said, being a police officer. But he really needed support and ongoing, relationships that would help him to continue in the in good, strong directions. And I don't think the school system that he was in did that particularly well.
Do you think that race and sort of sense of identity with racism around him played a role?
Oh, I think so. I think the only reason communities like that exist, and this was a community that, you know, was all, basically all Puerto Rican and African American children. They were all low-income children. They attended schools that were underfunded. I don't think those neighborhoods exist without racism. And I think that racism is, you know, a very, very strong piece in this conversation that a lot of people don't want to talk about. And even in schools, it's difficult sometimes because if you talk about race, you put yourself out there as perhaps being, you know, identifying race as the problem, which can be translated very easily into being prejudiced or biased. So how do you talk about it in a way that's productive and leads to positive social change without talking about it in a way that is sometimes not helpful? It's a thin line.
More on Literacy for Life when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. My kids started reading from the beginning. I read to them, and by me reading to them, they wanted to read. So that's probably the type of child they'll grow up to be. In this family, reading was a shared social practice, from exchanging books to sharing magazines. That's one of the cases that's explored in Reading Students' Lives, Literacy Learning Across Time by my guest, Catherine Compton Lilly. We're talking about Literacy for Life. Let's look at sort of the cases in this school that you worked with, school that was mostly low-income families who had a lot stacked against them. When you did find something where literacy was encouraged, how did that play out over time?
Yeah, I think literacy was encouraged in every single household. They did it in different ways. In every household, I never asked kids to bring me books, but they always brought me books. They would... because I was a teacher, I guess, you know, they knew I wanted to see books. Parents would show me the book they were reading the night before. They'd talk about reading books on the Oprah Book Club list. One mother loved reading American history. And I think this flies in the face of some of our assumptions about mm-hmm. people in urban communities. We think that there's no literacy if there's no books, and actually there are a lot of books and materials. In Alicia's family, and you just read a quote from Ms. Rodriguez, Alicia's mother, something really amazing kind of happened over time as I worked with the family. The very first time I went to visit, and I was Alicia's first grade teacher, and I'd actually taught her brother a few years before, so I already knew this family and this mom. But the first time I went to visit the house, Ms. Rodriguez says to her son, she goes, "Go into the back room and bring out that box of books." And I thought they were going to bring out a box of books, which they did, but the box of books was the size that a dishwasher would have come in. It was a huge box, and it was full of discarded library books and old school textbooks and books that they bought for the children and all sorts of books, some of them in really nice shape and some of them had been clearly used for a long, long time. But she used these books for her children. She had four boys who were older than Alicia, and then Alicia had a younger sister. And these had been books that she collected over time with the older boys and continued to use with the younger children. But what's really stunning about this account is that after this study ended, after the kids, you know, finished high school, I found Alicia 3 years later, and I found her older brother. And in both houses I went to, they were living separately. And first I went to her brother's house, and her brother said, "You know, we have a box of books in the back that we use with the children." because he had his own kids. And then I went to Alicia's house. She said exactly the same thing. They both had these boxes of books that they had saved for their own children. I just thought that was such a testament to the significance of literacy and reading and writing in this particular family. And it was a legacy that continued across generations.
Generational impact of something that was done when they were children that made books seem like treasures then. Do you find that just the physical presence of books in a family makes a big difference?
You know, I think that for some families, you know, that's their way of doing this stuff. I think for other families, they have lots of other ways. You know, I was talking about storytelling before. I also had a lot of parents talk to me about the games they play. So they play games in the car where kids are finding alphabet letters mm-hmm. or reading logos or doing all these activities, rhyming games, different sorts of activities that they do that are really very advanced because, you know, they're abstract and the children have to think about letters and sounds and words and, you know, rhyming games, those sorts of things. You're pulling words out of the air. So these are, you know, really powerful things that children do. Music is a huge thing. There's lots of music in the households I was in, and the children could often recite and perform the music. We talk a lot about phonemic awareness, which is kids' ability to be able to hear letters and sounds and rhymes and those sorts of things. And music is a perfect venue for doing that kind of work. And I think sometimes, you know, we think about storybook reading as the way to be literate and the thing that parents should do. And I think, you know, it's certainly something in the repertoire that, you know, is wonderful for parents to do with their children. But there's so many other things. There's rhymes, there's television shows, cartoons that have storylines with beginning, middle, and end, and problem solution. These are all things that can help kids learn in school. Sometimes the problem is, though, that the teacher doesn't realize that there's all of this literate stuff going on. And sometimes it's only looking and valuing particular ways of being literate.
How do you sort of work with this area that you're working with, which is, you know, populations that are traditionally underserved in the schools, that are disadvantaged, low income, and you want to sort of acknowledge the strikes against them. At the same time, you don't want the children to feel labeled and stigmatized and marginalized.
Yeah. I think we definitely want to address inequity. I think inequity is in our society. You know, as I've said already today, you know, the schools they're attending, at least in the cases of the children I wrote about, the communities they're living in are not equitable spaces, and they are not spaces that any children should be having to, or any family should be having to grapple with. And I don't think we ever want to lose sight of that, because otherwise we start to think that, you know, why don't they succeed? Why don't they learn? Without seeing the whole picture. But at the same time, we do want to value these amazing things going on in homes. Mm-hmm. And there is so much more literacy. There is so much more caring. There is so much more investment. So it's a really thin line. And this is one of the things that I try and work with teachers on. So I do a lot of work in you know, schools across the state and with the Wisconsin State Reading Association, working with teachers across the state to help them think about what are the bodies of knowledge and what are the literate practices that are going on in the communities where they teach, and to think about those. And also to think about what are some of the issues that children are grappling with in different parts of the state and different communities, and using literacy to, you know, perhaps create, write a script and make a video that will make mm-hmm. a case for some issue that needs to change, or to, you know, make some kind of a display or an art display that relates to some sort of issue that kids are interested in changing in their own communities. So thinking about not only the resources and practices that are going on in homes, but also thinking about how kids can use literacy to do things in their own communities and to make change.
I've seen some families where they are bilingual, yet don't recognize what an amazing gift and talent that is and how much that brings, instead just focusing on the fact that maybe they have an accent or something without realizing that they have children who are fluent in two languages without even having done so in school. Yeah.
And even to add on to that, there is some recent research that's showing that people that are bilingual have cognitive and metalinguistic abilities that people who are monolingual do not have, and that those last throughout your life and may even counter things like Alzheimer's. So, you're right. We don't think about the strengths that children bring. Sometimes we're so busy thinking about what they don't bring that we don't check to see what they do. And talking to parents and families is really important to find out what's going on.
Back to Alicia, the one mm-hmm. whose mother talked about reading to her children from the beginning and had the box of books and so on. How did you see her progress from first grade to becoming a mother herself?
Alicia did very well in school. She, was an AB student all the way through until she hit high school. And in high school, she was engaged in an altercation in a school hallway that was about someone getting pushed down the stairwell and a fight breaking out. And she actually got put on in-school suspension and was not allowed to attend her regular classes and had to attend all her classes in a separate wing of the building from December till June, and actually ended up then being a year behind in some of her classes and needed an extra year of high school. Meanwhile, she got pregnant and had her own kids. So, you know, again, we see these sorts of... One of the things I worry about with the children and the families is that if something like that happened to my own daughter, I would have financial resources. I would have, you know, political power to be able to go into that school and say, no, you're not going to do this. You know, when I saw things go wrong, there are resources and people that I could bring in on my behalf to make sure that my daughter was well served. Unfortunately, many children and families don't have those resources, and they don't have ways to counter school policies that might be problematic, which I argue this one definitely was. And then, you know, kids get frustrated, the parents get frustrated, and sometimes it's hard to come back from a hit. And I think middle-class families have a big advantage that way.
Is there any attempt on the part of that family to write about it? I mean, we've talked mostly about reading and boxes of books, but how have you followed also writing and the ability of a child and then later an adult to put in words, and then whether it's a letter to a school board or an editorial or something else, to use words as a weapon of sorts?
I haven't seen so much of that. I've had some students who came through school and were actually amazing writers, and I can tell you in a little bit about Peter, who was actually a stunning writer. But as far as using writing to change things, one of the parents talked a lot, not so much about writing, but making phone calls and calling her, you know, representatives in the city and in the state, you know, on different issues. But she kept talking about hitting brick walls, and you need someone to help you get around those walls. And she talked about teachers and medical professionals as sometimes people that help you to get access to resources that you can't. So I think often the families felt like there wasn't much they could do, but the best they could do was to find people that could help them to advocate. And sometimes that was successful and sometimes not. So I think it's a difficult space to be in.
Well, one of the things I was wondering about is, let's say you're working with a first grade class. How do you know at home what the parents are capable of doing? Because we still have attitudes about illiteracy that make people hide it.
The families that I worked with all had what I would consider, you know, a basic good literacy background, although not all the kids in my class at the time had parents who had those strengths. So there were parents who talked about how hard it was to learn to read, but, you know, the same parents would talk about reading the newspaper every day or those sorts of things. So none of the parents I worked with in this particular study had those challenges around literacy. But there were children in my class that had parents who didn't read or write, and there were parents in the study who talked about their own parents not being able to read and write. And I think one of the things you do is you find out what they are comfortable doing and what they're comfortable. They're often comfortable hearing their child read, because if they hear their child read, they might not be able to help him with all the hard words in that text, but they can at least listen, and they know when the story is going right. They know when it's making sense. So they can monitor it for that, and they can encourage the child to go back and check that word when it doesn't make sense. So they can help them monitor for comprehension, which is hugely important. One of the parents that I worked with for a long time who had trouble reading, she talked about always having her child watch TV with the captions.
Yeah.
And putting on the captions on the TV so that her daughter was always watching the words as well as hearing the sound. So I think sometimes parents are very, very resourceful. They often also have networks where there'll be a neighbor or a relative who they'll bring in to help with the homework and those sorts of things. So don't assume that just because a parent doesn't speak English or that a parent doesn't read or write, that they're necessarily not involved. They are often very resourceful and find ways to help their children.
You alluded to Peter and his writing. Can you talk about him?
Peter was probably, if you thought about school standards and school expectations, he was probably the most successful child in the sample. He moved through school with all A's and B's, did very well. When he got into middle school, he had a little bit of a setback. His family moved to New York City, and while they were in New York, he was attending a magnet school. So it was a school that had high caliber classes in the arts and sciences. And in order to get to that school from his home, he had to walk through the territory of another school, and he kept getting beat up on the way to school, so he actually stopped attending school. But, and then he moved back to the neighborhood where I was still teaching, and I reconnected with him, and he got back to his old school, and he did pretty well after that. He was a BC student after that, where he'd been an AB student before, but he did pretty well. But one of the things that happened while he was in New York City at this special school is his English teacher had told him, you could be a poet with the things you're coming up with. And he took that to heart, and he was writing poetry that was actually pretty stunning examples of poetry.
Can you share one of them?
Yeah. Here it is. This is called Not a Poet, and it's written by Peter when he was in 11th grade. I'm not a poet, just more an artist of words. I know what to use, when to use it, and where. Why? Attention. To be noticed and recognized as a romantic soul I am. But I'm not a poet. I write stories in the form of sad paragraphs to remember. To know me is to understand my poems, to know that I'm looking for love, love that will stay. But I'm not a poet. Poets write about sadness, what they have or want. I simply write stories in the form of sad paragraphs to remember.
That's beautiful, especially the part about an artist with words.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah. Yes.
He actually loved writing, and he wanted to go on to Columbia to study journalism. But he would have been the first person in his family to attend a four-year school. And he was in 11th grade when I spoke to him when he wrote this poem, and he still hadn't taken his ACTs. And he hadn't applied to colleges, and he hadn't been seriously looking. So some of it is sometimes the mentoring that they get. In the school he was at, the guidance counselors had loads of, 300, 400 students that they were supposed to be responsible for. So he ended up at a two-year school and is working a minimum wage job now, unfortunately. I think he had incredible talent.
Well, maybe he'll continue on later. I mean, one student that I worked with, who's no one in the family had graduated from high school, let alone college, but he said that college to him seemed like a chess game, where it looked like a really interesting, fun game that other people were playing, but no one had told him the rules. So how could he play this game? If no one explained how it worked, what the bishop and the rook did and so on. And I think, for first generation college students, it's very difficult and confusing process sometimes if they're trying to break out of a pattern. More on Literacy for Life when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I am not a good reader. I'm not a reader. I don't read. If they tell me, like, Germaine, read, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't like reading, and reading is not me. I only read if I have to, and that's like a test. That's the only way I'm going to read. If you call on me to read, I'm not going to read. I cannot read out loud. I could read to myself good. Those are the comments of Germaine, one of the students profiled in the book Reading Students' Lives, Literacy Learning Across Time, by my guest, Catherine Compton Lilly. Let's talk about Germaine and about resistance to reading. We've talked about how families have a surprising amount of literacy activities and encouragement of their children in school, even if it may not be apparent to most teachers. But you are going to be encountering children who are avoiding at all costs reading, especially reading in front of people.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, Germaine is one of the kids who had trouble learning to read from the very beginning. He struggled when he was in first grade. We got some extra special help, and he made some gains but never quite caught up with the other children. Reading and writing were always very hard for him. But it wasn't because his parents weren't involved, and it wasn't because his parents didn't care. His parents, you know, were always concerned, always interested. They bought him a computer and online programs to be able to help him practice his reading skills and those sorts of things. Both his mother and father could both read and write. They were literate themselves. And they were very, very dedicated to trying to help him. But reading was always hard. By the time he got into middle school, he was classified as a special education student with a learning disability. So that was hard for him.
Would it be like dyslexia or just some other...
I'm not sure that I ever knew exactly what the disability was. I know that he was pulled out for extra help and that he did have an IEP because his mom had gone in for the meetings. But one of the things in the interviews is there's some things people want to talk about and there's some things they choose not to. So, you know, the specific nature of the disability was something that his parents were less interested in discussing with me. But he did struggle.
I would think that struggling in school and having this sort of fear of being forced to read out loud and to be made to feel embarrassed by that would have a profound impact on attitude towards school and one's future.
Yeah, for sure. Although I must admit that there were some books he found. So he found a series of books that were written in an easy level but were written for older kids. So they're about, you know, boy and girl issues and school issues and those sorts of things. But they're actually written in a way that's they're made for kids who have, you know, disabilities with reading. So he loved those books. He got into those. He did get excited about certain things in school. There were certain teachers he liked. So you're right. It does color their kind of... whether or not they think they're a good student, whether or not they feel they're capable, whether or not they feel like they're learning. It certainly had a huge effect on that. But even with that, there were still things that he found to enjoy and appreciate in school. However, he did not pass his tests every year that he was taking, and he ended up being retained in seventh grade and then being retained twice more in eighth grade. So he ended up being 16 years old and still in the eighth grade classroom. Which was horrific. I'm not sure that's the way you help kids learn, by continuing to retain them repeatedly. And he was actually, the last time I talked to him, he should have been in 11th grade and he was still in 8th grade. So, you know, this is an example of an incredibly dysfunctional school and school system that was, you know, some people would argue what they were trying to do was to push him out. Because they've, you know, he sometimes would get in trouble. He sometimes caused trouble. He'd get in fights with other kids. Mm-hmm. And I think the school was retaining him with the hope that he would just drop out at some point. So it was a really hard story, especially, you know, when you understand that he did have a learning disability.
I wonder how many children who get in trouble in school are actually masking a learning disability. There were cases that I know of where children would act up when it was time to read,
yes,
where they knew they would be asked to read aloud,
yes,
they would then, you know, fall out of their chair or cause a commotion or do something to get sent to the principal's office, as opposed to having to be exposed as someone who couldn't read.
Yeah.
So, you know, this sort of acting up and then ultimately getting in trouble with the law as a way of kind of getting out of,
yeah,
this embarrassing,
situation.
Horrible situation where you're supposed to read and other kids are laughing or tittering, and, you know, it's a problem that I think has been there for a long time.
And then there's a flip side to it, in the sense that if you're, you know, if you're tough and you stand up to the other kids and you're willing to fight and all those sorts of things, people aren't going to make fun of you because you can't read.
Mm-hmm.
So it masks it in two ways. It gets you out of the situation, but it also gives you a positioning with your peers where they won't say the things that they might have said if they weren't a little intimidated by you.
I have a memory that's stuck with me since second grade from a Middleton Elementary – Madison Elementary School, where a second grade teacher wrote an easy word on the board and said, "Look, class, Mark cannot even read this word." And this humiliation of a child who stumbled with words, you know, I still to this day remember that, singling out someone who can't read. If you do have children in the classroom who are scared of reading aloud, what are some of the let's say you're a parent or you're a teacher and you have a child who doesn't want to read aloud,
yeah,
what are some of the things that you can do so that reading becomes not a painful exercise in humiliation.
One of the things I talk to classroom teachers about is avoiding that, avoiding what we used to call round robin reading, where everyone read a couple sentences and then you go to the next kid and the next kid and everyone performs this reading. And sometimes the kids can be a little nasty to each other, even in ways the teacher might not see, but the kids are very aware of. So one of the things we do is we don't do that anymore. We discourage teachers from having kids read aloud in front of their peers. And actually, that practice is highly problematic in another sense, is that when you do round-robin reading and you add up the number of minutes kids read per day, it comes to something like 7 minutes a day. And kids are never going to learn to be good readers by reading 7 minutes a day. So what we encourage teachers to do is to now introduce a book or a story or some materials and then have all the children read it independently and then come back together and talk about ideas and issues in the book or whatever it is you want to teach. But, you know, that way you get all the kids reading for 15 minutes instead of each kid reading for a couple minutes here or there. So really getting kids to spend more time with connected text and, you know, following up with the instruction instead of, you know, having them perform for each other. Because you also remember sitting there waiting for your turn and often not following the words in the book, you know, doing something else.
Skipping ahead and looking at what you were likely to be having to read when it
practicing your section.
Or something like that. On the other hand, I would think that the skill of opening a book and reading from it or reading something that's, you know, right in front of you is something that should be developed along the way as well.
Yes. But I think that can be done, and we do have kids read aloud to us in schools, and it is incredibly important if you want to assess a child and know anything about their reading ability. You need to hear the child read connected text. So we now do assessments where we pull children off to the side one by one and have them read with the teacher. So the peer group is not able to witness any of the challenges. And we also make sure that we're having kids read books that are within what we call their zone of proximal development, where it's not too hard, it's not too easy, but it's books that they'll actually learn a little bit about reading by reading.
The author, Matthew Desmond, who wrote Evicted, the 2016 Go Big Read selection here at UW, also a Pulitzer Prize winning study of homelessness in Milwaukee and some of the struggles with housing, did field research where he was actually living in low-income trailer parks and getting to know families who were being forced out of their homes, struggling to keep families together and so on. And he talked in the afterword, I remember, about this problem as a researcher of watching crises, watching families that were, you know, being kicked out of homes in the winter or just needed a few extra dollars to be able to stay in their apartment. And this keeping this distance as a researcher, but then also being a human being who got attached to these families he was studying. I was wondering if you could talk about your own journey with children whose lives you see unfolding in front of you, and you're studying them, you're recording what's happening, but you must also be finding yourself drawn in.
Yeah. That was definitely the hardest thing about doing this work. Is one of the things that made it a little bit different is that I visited the kids when they were, well, they were my first grade students, and then I visited them again when they were in fifth grade, and then in eighth grade, and then in 11th grade. So every time I went to see them, years had gone by. So sometimes I wasn't firsthand witnessing the things, but I was hearing about what had happened in the interim. So that was very, very hard. But there were also times when you saw things, you saw kids in situations at school or in the community where you just knew it wasn't right and it shouldn't happen. And this was, you know, my first study that I had done. And I think that, you know, as I look back, I wish I'd intervened more. I wish I had found ways to, you know, go to teachers and go to schools and say, look, this is not okay. And I think I'll always regret not being a bit more aggressive. We've got another study going on right now, actually, in Wisconsin, where we're following children from immigrant families. So these are kids whose families have immigrated from Mexico or Morocco or Nepal or Korea or China. And we're following those children. And I'm actually working with a team of graduate students. And one of the things I've been very adamant with for my team is that if they need something, let's try and figure it out. So at this point, I still want to record their stories, but we're much more aggressive in the sense that if people express a need, if they need to know who to go to at the school to help with this, or if they need, you know, some food stamps to do X, or if they need help filling out a form, or they don't understand the PEOPLE program, which help kids, you know, move mm-hmm. towards college, we're being much more aggressive in trying to provide resources and to do things to intervene. Because I'm less interested in, you know, the untouched story and more interested in being a support for them. And I think that's one of the reasons that they allow us to come back. The study that we're doing now, we're visiting families 3 times every year. So we're much more close contact and ongoing contact with the families. And I think that, you know, we've been much more out there in terms of offering support and being available. And I think that's an ethical question that I've had to come to, and I agree totally with the author of Evicted.
Sometimes I watch journalists who are reporting from, like, war-torn zones, and there's somebody fainting right by them, and I feel like, you know, put the microphone down and help.
You know,
how about CPR? How about getting them to – it's the I guess the stereotype of the researcher in the ivory tower who is studying poverty but doing nothing to change it, or working with some kind of mental health crisis and not – You talk in your book about a student named Christy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that?
Christy was in my first grade class, and like Marvin, she had been retained. So this was her second time in first grade, so she was a year older than the other children. She was half African-American and half white, so she was a biracial student. She lived with her mother, and her mother had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and had a hard time. Her mother had actually been a brilliant high school student, and her own mother had been a teacher. So it was interesting that we had parents whose parents had been teachers in the sample. Like I said, both her and Marvin's grandfather's mother had been a teacher. But by the time Christy was moving into grade 5, her mother had found a new boyfriend, and this boyfriend had had a difficult past himself. He'd been incarcerated multiple times, and social services felt that it wasn't appropriate to have Christy and her sister living in the same household with this gentleman, and they were actually removed and placed into foster care. And they stayed in foster care for about 5 years and were eventually adopted by a family. So one of the things that happened with this case is, and this is another piece where I think a lot about my role as a researcher, is by the time I was talking to Christy when she was in 8th grade and 11th grade, she'd asked me questions about, what was my mother like? Did my mother read? What was I like as a little girl? You know, what were the things I was interested in? You know, do you remember me when I was little? Because she had no one in her life that knew her as a child. She had no photographs of herself except for ones that I brought to her. You know, I shared with her some of the things I had written about her and her family, and she were things she didn't know her mother had played the flute. She didn't know her mother had a 2-year college degree. So, you know.
So you were the link to the family history at that point.
I was the link to the past. And, you know, I think that's another testament, is that some children are, you know, moving through our society without, you know, without their own stories and without their own chains of who they are. So that was a really interesting and poignant kind of, and I think about, you know, what that means in terms of my relationship with Christy, and how nice it would have been had the school been able to do some of that and to be there for her over time. But she, as she moved among families, she moved among schools and really had no long-term relationships.
Well, thank you for the work that you do throughout the state on literacy, and especially exploring it over time and showing the importance of tracking students as they go through school. My guest has been Catherine Compton Lilly, and we are talking about Literacy for Life.
Thank you, Emily.
I'm Emily Auerbach. Hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.